Good afternoon and welcome to the latest in our series of Senate Occasional Lectures. My name is Anthony Marinac and I'm Director of Research in the Senate Procedure Office. Harry Evans, the clerk, has sent his apologies. He's unavailable today because the Senate is unexpectedly sitting today and demands his attention. I'm immensely honoured today to have the opportunity to introduce to you Emeritus Professor Colin Hughes. As a PhD graduate of the University of Queensland's Political Science Department, a significant proportion of my undergraduate and postgraduate years were spent either listening to Professor Hughes's lectures or reading his textbooks. He's a towering figure in Australian political science. As an academic, he holds a master's degree from Columbia University and a doctorate from the London School of Economics. He was first appointed as a professor of political science at the University of Queensland in 1965 and later took up a professorial position here at the ANU in the mid-1970s. His handbooks of Australian government and politics, published in 1968, 77, 86 and 99, are the standard reference works recording our parliamentary history in intricate detail from 1890 until the present day. In addition, Professor Hughes has had a long career in public service outside the university environment. As a member of Queensland's Electoral and Administrative Review Commission, he was among those people responsible for unravelling the Bjelke-Petersen gerrymander in Queensland. He has accepted appointments to the Queensland Local Government Electoral and Boundaries Review Commission and the Queensland Constitutional Review Commission. He's also served on the board of the International Institute for Democratic and Electoral Assistance, an international body devoted to assisting the developing world to improve the quality of both electoral processes and parliamentary governance. He was Australia's first independent electoral commissioner, filling that post from 1984 until 1989, and he remains a sought-after public observer on electoral practices and electoral fairness, and remains a prolific academic. And I was asked, by the way, to give a plug to some of his recent work, which appears as part of the Democratic Audit, flyers and bookmarks for which are located outside the venue today. I, for one, am very grateful that he's taken the time to be here today to address us on the topic of the independence of electoral administration. Professor.
Thank you very much. I'm grateful to the Senate for the opportunity of talking to you and grateful to you all for bothering to come along on to hear about a topic which, as I'll say at the beginning, isn't one of, or hasn't been one of the liveliest in the land. As a topic for serious study, electoral administration has been a late starter. Classic political philosophers like Rousseau, John Stuart Mill wrote about electoral systems and theories of representation. So did historians of Greece and Rome and the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire and the United Kingdom and the United States and so on. But such writers almost always ignored the low-level mechanics of who did exactly what when elections were taking place, the one virtuous exception being Jeremy Bentham. As an undergraduate fossicking in the second-hand bookshops which once stood where the bank and the fund now rule the world, I acquired two volumes entitled How the World Votes. Their author, and those after that kind introduction will think, so that's how the twig was bent. But their author was a Yale professor, Charles Seymour, with his research assistant shown as co-author. Seymour is still well known today for his account, written a few years earlier, of the development of the English electoral system after the Great Reform Act. To start this lecture, I want to ask why the how in the later title was ignored for so long. I think it'll help if we look at the subtitles of those books for a moment. In 1915, Seymour added, quote, "The development and operation of the parliamentary franchise, 1832 to 1885. And in 1918, The Story of Democratic Developments in Elections." By 1918, democracy was seen as a good thing, though not necessarily always suitable for export and adoption. Look at what was being said about Iraq in the Covenant of the League of Nations, the text of the subsequent mandate, and indeed in the special report in 1931 for ending the mandate. And what is said about Iraq today? Well, at least they had a bloody good election. What developing democracy traditionally meant in the context of elections was extension of the franchise to eventually all adults. But since the end of World War II, that meaning has expanded, as we'll see. When Seymour reached elections in the British colonies, those colonies which were about to become dominions, his praise was fulsome. These self-governing commonwealths represent in many ways the furthest development of the democratic idea that the world has seen. In particular, they had curbed plutocracy and reformed the hereditary upper house. The methods of rule-keeping in Canada and Australia were described briefly, and he noted that Australia has gone far in developing the technical details of holding elections. Unlike the mother country, where untrained officials produced often unsatisfactory roles, and, I quote him, electoral duties were regarded as of comparative unimportance and shifted onto the backs of already overloaded officials, Australia has a wealth of electoral officials who have nothing else to do but to see that the mechanism of elections runs smoothly, end of quote. The significance of that development has been discussed elsewhere. In practice, the wealth of officials meant a full-time junior official who did the routine work and a more senior officer with other non-electoral duties as well, located in every electoral district. The Commonwealth Constitution calls them divisions and sociali, plus very small establishments at state and federal level supervising them. The whole organisation was known as the Electoral Office and formed part of a large ministerial department for budgetary and personal administration purposes. Writing a few years later than Seymour, Lord Bryce, having defined democracy as meaning, quote, nothing more nor less than the rule of the whole people, expressing their sovereign will by their votes, was equally approving of Australia. It is the newest of all the democracies. It is that which has travelled farthest and fastest along the road which leads to the unlimited rule of the multitude. That was certainly true. Adult male suffrage, abolition of plural voting and property franchise, suffrage for women were far and fast indeed. Bryce also mentioned several local innovations that extended the franchise, but went on to say that, quote, the counting of votes appears to be everywhere honestly conducted and one hears no complaints of bribery, end of quote, whilst noting limitations had been imposed on campaign expenditure and the likelihood that elections were getting more expensive. What Bryce didn't write about, nor did anyone until Robert Parker 40 years later, was the Australian tendency to turn adjudication of some important decisions over to independent bodies. It's important for today's topic, and again it's a matter written about previously. When I say such things, bear in mind there'll be a footnote in the final version. When developing electoral administration, the Australian colonies had originally followed British footsteps fairly closely, but as the post-Bentham era of reforms unfolded, sometimes the Australians were a few paces ahead, sometimes the British. The franchise began as a property right and as such was suitable for adjudication in the ordinary courts of law. But when the numbers of electors grew and their qualifications had been reduced and simplified, it proved easier to turn disputes over to a specialised court that came into existence ad hoc when rolls were being compiled to hear disputes about eligibility between interested parties. The new federal government immediately created what were called special courts of revision, comprising the electoral official charged with keeping the roll in his division and either a magistrate or a couple justices of the peace. The matter remained with those special courts briefly, then the magistrate or justices of the peace were dropped. That left enrolment disputes to the official responsible for roll maintenance in that division, subject to appeal up the bureaucratic hierarchy. Disputes about membership of the House of Commons, membership of the Lords, of course, is a very different question, could concern either eligibility to be elected or the conduct of the poll. In either case, it was considered the responsibility of that chamber, which would appoint a select committee to investigate. Eventually, responsibility passed to a special court, consisting of a superior judge, and the Australian colonies untidily over time followed suit. Another electoral problem took the same course away from the legislative branch. By 1902, when the Commonwealth first legislated, the time was already ripe for what Seymour would soon describe. Routine electoral matters were turned over to public servants, a process which was encouraged by the demands made by a continuous roll. New Zealand and New South Wales had already innovated in a closely related area by turning the drawing of division boundaries over to an official. When the Commonwealth started, that was a single official. Quite soon it was changed to three officials. However, that legislation set criteria to be applied by the officials, and each chamber retained the right to reject the officials' proposals and require them to try again. There still remains some uncertainty whether the provisions of the Commonwealth Electoral Act, which I'll keep referring to as the CEA, monopolise the electoral sphere, or can other legislation dealing with review of administrative decisions offer an alternative remedy, but that lively hare won't be pursued now. Corrupt acts affecting the electoral process went to the ordinary courts. Electoral offences, they were called generally, but in the CEA they were divided into three categories. Those committed by electoral officials and called, quote, breach or neglect of official duty. Those committed by political activists and called, quote, illegal practices, which included bribery and undue influence, and those likely to be committed by ordinary citizens, which were also called electoral offences. Offences were prohibited and penalised, and I quote the Act, to secure the due execution of this Act and to ensure the purity of elections, with savage penalties. Imprisonment with maximum terms of 2 years, 1 year or 6 months, depending on the offence, or fines of £200 or £50 maximum. Bear in mind we're talking 1902. The only cut-price offence on offer was defacing a removal official notices at £2 maximum, but it's still a tidy sum for those days. Breach or neglect of official duty was near the top of the range, with a maximum of 1 year or a £200 fine, which is not surprising for an era where public service ethics rested on a penalty-based disciplinary system. Independence, a word in the title of this lecture, from interference by another in a sphere of government activity, usually has a close connection to the status and reputation of the person or persons undertaking that activity. By 1902, judges had more than two centuries of independence under their belts, public servants nearly half a century. Both the politically active and the mass public would have had fairly clear and firmly held beliefs about the integrity and independence of judges and public servants, reinforced as they were by the severe sanctions of loss of a relatively good and certainly secure job and possible criminal prosecution. It remained possible for a deus ex machina to be invoked if and when it was thought necessary, which was rare. A select committee reviewed the first election conducted by federal officials in 1903 and was generally satisfied with arrangements. A royal commission sat in 1913 when some things were thought to have gone wrong at that election. It ended the last vestige of the overload Seymour wrote about by making the senior official in each division's two-person office also a full-time electoral official. One might say that Australia's characteristic talent for bureaucracy had triumphed once more because it appeared to work well. In a wider context, the point has been made, paradoxically, electoral governance attracts serious attention not when it produces good elections, but when it occasionally produces bad ones. It is this paradox that has obscured the empirical relevance and analytical significance of electoral governance. The Australian system of electoral administration was paralleled in each state for their own elections, save they did not have officials permanently stationed in each of their electoral districts, but recruited other officials ad hoc when an election came on. It became a familiar and trusted part of the Australian political landscape, and as a consequence, nobody wrote about it. Regular tinkering with and occasional substantial changes too, the electoral system meant that Parliament often had an opportunity to say something about the administrative implications of those matters, and in particular members would avail themselves of the opportunity to mention local grievances, like the availability of polling places, but these rarely had a sustained partisan flavour. Significant for future talk and writing about Australian electoral administration, though not at that time, was the struggle in the 1940s and early 1950s for control of the international trade union movement waged by the American Federation of Labour and the International Congress of Free Trade Unions as part of the Cold War. It led to the electoral office being given responsibilities for the conduct of trade union elections as well as parliamentary elections, and the former proved to be much more prone to disputes and consequent litigation in the courts than the latter ever were. Not until the early 1970s and the coming to office of the Whitlam government was serious and sustained consideration given to major changes to the electoral system and associated with it to the ability of what had become something of an inbred bureaucratic backwater to cope with major additions to its responsibilities and with the consequences of change in Australian society and party politics. Thanks to the responsible minister, Fred Daly, a modest increase in the staffing of the divisional offices was achieved and roll maintenance computerised, but that did little more than recognise the massive growth in enrolments and the number of enrolment transactions every year. The electoral office was made a statutory authority and thus slightly more at arm's length from its ministerial department. Its senior officials were made statutory officers and so removable only by Parliament, but these changes only gave legal form to existing practice. The Hawke government came to office in 1983 with what was potentially a substantial program for change inherited from the Whitlam period, but chose to work through a Joint Select Committee on Electoral Reform, the JSCER, in the first instance. I will mention only those changes which resulted from that process that are germane to this lecture's subject, the independence of electoral administration. For the benefit of anyone present familiar with a paper on that subject published a few years ago, I will try to avoid repeating what was said then. Both the major parties, Labour and Liberal, recommended creation of an independent electoral commission, and the JSCER saw, I quote, great merit in the existence of an Australian Electoral Commission, the AEC, with a statutory basis and which is seen to operate independent of political influence, close quotes, and recommended accordingly. The JSCER proposed that the AEC carry on all the current functions of the electoral office, and in particular a statutory basis should be given to what had already started on a limited and intermittent basis, research, information and education programs. But the JSCER also proposed involving the AEC in what would have to be relatively novel responsibilities. In 1902, a relatively recent British precedent had been copied and limits set for campaign expenditure, but the provisions had been largely ignored in practice. Eventually they were repealed by the Fraser government when the possibility that they might be applied actually arose. The JSCER considered two closely related issues, the first being introduction of partial public funding of election expenditure, and the second, the reimposition of an obligation to disclose expenditure, now coupled with imposition of a new and additional obligation to disclose the sources of donations. Whilst a great many of the JSCER's recommendations were supported by both major parties, the area of those two issues was charged with partisan feeling, attributable presumably to the widely held belief that the Liberal Party benefited more substantially from the current unregulated situation than did the Labour Party. With the support of minor party members in the Senate, the Hawke government was able to legislate along the lines laid down by the JSCER majority. In the more than 20 years since then, there has been, I think, widespread acceptance that there should be public funding and that there should be some degree of disclosure, but considerable partisan feeling hangs over the details of both. Another field of activity which can generate trouble is the registration of political parties, but to make sure that we don't run out of time, I'll leave that for the final version and move to the third and final point. The JSCER proposed enhancing the AEC independence compared to the electoral offices by abandoning the power of each chamber to fail to pass or reject a redistribution scheme for a particular state and require the redistribution commissioners to try again. Lest this be thought a minor matter, for the last instances are now 30 years in the past, there were 17 instances of rejection and 14 instances of a scheme lapsing before the parliamentary veto power was removed. Indeed, there had been speculation whether the possibility of rejection might inhibit the independence of the redistribution commissioners. The majority of the JSCER wisely chose to rely instead on appearances and said, I quote, believed that to reinforce to the maximum extent possible the independence of the Commission and to ensure as much as possible the removal of its conclusions from the political sphere, the conclusion of the Electoral Commission with respect to redistribution should be final, and that's what the legislation provided. In a dissenting report, Sir John Carrick, the senior Liberal member of the JSCER, suggested at the final stage of the redistribution, the proposal should be placed before Parliament, which might make its own comments or recommendations. The Redistribution Commission should consider these and then make their decisions, which would be final. Now, that's been a short history of how we, that is Australia, got to where we are today, and it's time to start looking around and asking questions. I'd like to think this is undoubtedly a popular topic, and quote from a recent work, from Afghanistan to Burundi to Liberia to Palestine, today's headlines are full of situations in which electoral processes go forward in the face of tremendous changes for conflict management. The reason is clear. In today's world, no government can claim to rule legitimately without some degree of deference to the will of the people. To begin at the beginning, the first critical decision has to be the choice of an electoral system, how to convert votes into seats. For some time, Australia has used bicameralism to have two bob each way, and whilst there are proposals abroad for tinkering with each system, their only impact on electoral administration is the increased burden complexity of the voting process places on an administrative authority that is expected to explain these variations to the electorate. Next is the question of how electoral systems affect party systems. Which at present is the extent to which proportional representation increases the number of minor and mini-partisan offer. And finally, and back to our subject, there will be fundamental considerations of electoral administration. Research has shown that the structure, balance, composition and professionalism of the electoral management body, such as an electoral commission, I'm quoting again, is a key component in successful electorate processes that generate legitimate accepted outcomes. But it's a great truth that has been recognised only recently. I quote from a different source, the organisation of elections was traditionally a specialist backwater of the administrations of established democracies, often located within the government or local government service. Individual committed officials worked in their electoral service for many years, often in isolation and with their role unrecognised. Now, does the international scene have anything to do with us? Australia hasn't had a civil war like Afghanistan and the others. Elections in such countries have generated a literature of their own, and organisations have sprung into existence to assist, some based on a single national benefactor, and others truly international in their composition and funding. Australian electoral administration is good enough to export to the less fortunate, and the AEC and its officials have been vigorously engaged in the activity since 1983, as its annual reports document and a comment by the Prime Minister about Iraq puts beyond question. Do we really need to worry about the maintenance of what is a long accepted administrative structure or the avoidance of politico-administrative ills we never have experienced? Now, what I do in the written paper is look at the experience of four countries, Nigeria, Bangladesh, Mexico, and the United States, in a little bit of detail because they were all sort of current at the moment that I was writing the paper. Since then, I've seen that Ecuador should have been on the list because the Ecuador Electoral Tribunal has just said that 57 members of the opposition may not enter the Congress House, which is a fairly dramatic development on the Ecuadorian front. The conclusion I draw from those four cases, and there could have been many more, the field is still very active, is that there's nothing magical about an electoral commission. It can be set up with inadequate responsibilities and powers and be recognised as inconsequential. The principles on which its members are selected are important, as are the circumstances in which they can be removed individually or collectively. A commission can be caught up in political conflict and become the pawn of more powerful forces, or it can establish itself as a respected independent force able to resolve political conflict, as has happened in Mexico. The rest of the lecture will address a series of questions about this is how most likely to be achieved. The first question is whether a statutory foundation is sufficient, or should the Electoral Commission be entrenched in the Constitution? There are three pretty obvious truths to start with. 30 years have passed since the Australian electorate got up enough speed to carry a constitutional referendum, and we have only to consider the level of affirmative voting in 1988 on parliamentary terms and fair elections. Next, amendments may not get things quite right the first time, and I cite a particular matter. I had prepared an ad lib to modify the text, and mercifully reading the Canberra Times this morning, I see I have to amend my ad lib in the light of current developments. The 1977 amendment on Senate vacancies failed to catch the first case that arose after it had been adopted because the party that had put Steele Hall there had ceased to exist. Finally, the fact that the Commonwealth Constitution says something should exist is no guarantee it will exist. What could be said to a Martian visitor to Canberra who asked to be taken to the Interstate Commission? Perhaps tell him it was intended to regulate river transport and he'll understand. What if he says, I've been bugging up the Constitution with a view to passing my citizenship test at the first crack? But if I caught the magic flounder and it offered me one amendment in return for its freedom, I would rather try to guarantee a right to vote. It should be remembered that there are well-known points at which the Constitution pinches electoral administration. For example, introducing a fixed term would assist administration in preparing for things, but it runs up against the Governor-General's power to dissolve contained in Section 28. Therefore, you've got to amend the Constitution. There is current a very interesting point following the statutory change passed in 2006 to close the rolls on the day that the writ for an election issues. It brings into play Section 12, which allocates the power to issue writs for Senate elections and the state governors, and their power to do this has traditionally been regulated by state legislation. Current provisions either give the local Governor General in Council discretion, or for Victoria, adopt the 1983 amendment to the CAA, as that state did generally with its electoral legislation, and specify the close of rolls being 7 days after the date of the writ. The federal government apparently relies on Section 109 to claim that such a provision is inconsistent with the Commonwealth law and to that extent invalid, and it may well be that Commonwealth law determines what could be put on the writ. But whether the Commonwealth can compel a state governor to issue a Senate writ may be a different matter, and one can only say watch this space. The second question is how specific or broad should electoral legislation be? In other words, how much discretion should an electoral commission have when conducting an election? Over the years, the CEA has grown in length, and the regulations made under it have shrunk, and that is a good thing. But there will always be matters where a wide discretion is required. If you are going to enforce compulsory voting as the Act requires, then something like Section 245, subsection 4 is necessary. The DRO, the man in charge, or man or now woman in charge of the division, is not now required to send a penalty note if he or she is satisfied that the elector D had a valid and sufficient reason for failing to vote. Parliamentarians should not have to spend their time considering what should or should not be included in a list of reasons that would qualify as valid and sufficient and amending it after every election. Possibly, I say diffidently, some of them have not seen enough of the world to even imagine some of the reasons that are put forward. On the other hand, discretion demands careful consideration. Take Section 268, subsection 3. A ballot paper shall not be informal for any reason other than the reasons specified in this section, but shall be given effect to according to the voter's intention, so far as that intention is clear. A rhyming couplet in the past was easily remembered, when in doubt, throw it out. But it hardly complies with the intention of the legislation to preserve the voter's right to have their vote counted, if that is possible. On a related point, casual observers of the political scene are at risk of mistaking where responsibility lies and whither criticism should be directed. To take a current issue, the ability of candidates who qualify for public funding to show a profit on the operation, the one news story might refer to, quote, federal electoral law, or the rules, or the AEC rules which allow this. It is unlikely to say that there once was a statutory provision preventing such an abuse, but it was deleted by agreement of the major parties once they found it an inconvenient distraction from the main game of spending as much as they could, as quickly as they could. The third question is whether there should be some protective machinery involving the legislature to act as a counterbalance to the executive's natural and pervasive influence. Some countries bring their courts into play for this purpose, presumably Ecuador, but because of the view that Australian and US courts have taken of dangers to the separation of powers doctrine, we can more usefully concentrate on the legislature. The news that JSCER was going to morph into a permanent feature of the electoral landscape was good news, and some years of living with the Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters, the JSCEM, did not undermine my belief in parliamentary committees. However, it is possible that the relative stability of government since 1983, two governments each outlasting more than a decade, has left a feeling that something's wrong with the system, it's not throwing the rascals out as it should. And two other phenomena of the period, a propensity to strengthen a few components of government machine at the expense of the rest, and an intensification of partisanship in public life, an attack campaigning on the American model in electoral competition, contribute to this feeling. But having said that, it certainly is the case that the evidence engendered by the JSCM's inquiries and its subsequent reports constitute a unique body of material on electoral administration in detail. The fourth question is whether the leadership of an electoral commission can be protected from partisan influence, and if so, how? The South Australian branch of the Labor Party had suggested to the JSCER that the first chief executive officer should be chosen, quote, on the recommendation of an independent select committee and thereafter by the AE itself. But the JSCER preferred the more usual Governor-General in Council appointment. This in practice followed interviews conducted by a committee of relevant permanent heads. Although the defeat of the Whitlam government in 1975 effectively brought an end to administrative reform in the electoral office, it coincided with the retirement of the long-serving Frank Lee and led to the first appointment in living memory of an outsider coming from the Prime Minister's department to that most senior office, then called Chief Electoral Officer. And since then, no insider has been appointed. What I think is probably more important as a guarantee of independence is that no incumbent has been reappointed when their first statutory term came to an end. If a convention has developed, and one must always be reluctant to say that, I think it's a useful one. This is not a matter of removing self-interest as a consideration when unpleasant decisions have to be made, but of preventing any appearance of self-interest might have operated. And curiously, the point at which the discretion of the Governor-General in Council is partly fettered concerns the chairman, one of the two part-time commissioners, who has to be selected from a panel of three, quote, from the Act, eligible judges, supplied by the chief judge. I think this formula really is designed, or was designed, to maintain the proper arm's length between the judiciary and a politically sensitive appointment, and may well have been extracted by the chief judge as a condition. For the other part-time member, another convention again appears to have started that the appointee will always be the Commonwealth statistician, and again it is a wise step. It will always be possible for a government so inclined, and provided it controls both houses of the Parliament, to nibble away a bit of independence by so legislating, rather than picking the right person to do it administratively. And thus the Act previously said, to take one example of what might be a problem, the office of a divisional returning officer shall, unless the Commission otherwise directs, be located within the division. The location of divisional offices was the subject of tension between the AEC and some members of Parliament, and within the Commission between the central office and divisional staff, primarily because the section's clear implication of each division having its own small office and existing staff's satisfaction with the arrangement ran counter to the cost and other benefits of consolidating several offices into a larger one in metropolitan and large provincial city areas. Eventually now, by the Electoral and Referendum Amendment, Electoral Integrity and Other Measures, Act, the provision became the office of a divisional returning officer must be located within the division unless the Minister has given written authority for the office not to be so located. And it was added such a written authority was not a legislative instrument, the significance of which I need hardly explain to this audience. This may be a one-off bit of business pressed by a few backbenchers or even former backbenchers, or it may be a tentative toe in the water with a view to bringing the minister back, restoring the camel's nose to the inside of the tent. In the United States, for example, the location of and allocation of resources to polling places have been highly controversial matters at recent elections, as I think most people would know. Fifth and finally, are some electoral administration functions more dangerous to exercise, i.e. more likely to lead to an attack on independence than others? Or, coming at it from a different angle, has the expansion of responsibility since 1983 put the AEC more frequently into the political firing line than the old electoral office ever was? One has only to mention removal of the parliamentary veto of redistributions, entanglement in parties' internal affairs, enforcing disclosure, contributing to electoral education, and to various international problems, international contacts. Some of the examples of those are, for example, the likelihood that effective controls in Australia will only drive the offending operation overseas, the possibility of web and blogging defamation, money and messages being sent from outside the jurisdiction, the swarm of front and fellow travelling organisations that may surround a contemporary political party, even terrorism and the measures taken to fight it. All of these can raise international problems, and I think ask you to appreciate how far the political environment that surrounds electoral administration has changed and the extent to which the newer responsibilities have thrust the AEC into the middle of it. I think the conclusion to draw from this is that understanding its past may help to protect its future. And I thank you for your presence and attention.
Professor, thank you. We'll follow our usual practice for those many of you who are our regulars, if you have questions, if you could please go to one of the microphones. I'm sure the Professor would be happy to provide answers.
Hi, Colin. Peter Brent, ANU. You mentioned the joint select committees and the first joint committee in 1904 and then the other Royal Commission in a decade later and how they restarted in the 80s. What's the history of them between those dates? Were there periods where there was a lot of parliamentary analysis of committee analysis of the previous election? Did they stop when, you know, in the long period of the Menzies government, for example?
Yep. I'm disadvantaged in answering that question at the moment because, for a quite different purpose, I've been reading a lot of old Hansards, basically pre-1948, and surprised at how many references you pick up by looking at Home Affairs and then the sub-reference electoral. There was a lot of going on, sniping about little things, and indeed in a paper that I hope may one day soon appear on the Democracy Audit site, you get my gleanings from that exercise. People were using occasions, even grievance days, to raise electoral matters. Therefore, that experience clouds my judgment. I would have said probably your premise is right that the JSCR has taken it off to an appropriate forum, but I don't know enough about how questions have changed over the years, how far, for example, the independent question is like the Tasmanian tiger, to be treasured if you think you've seen one, and how far what we're really looking at is the control of question time by ministerial offices and the like, and there's little concern in ministerial offices, most of the ministers having safe seats, which is why they're ministers, in these minutiae of electoral administration. It's a good question. I'm not sure if one went away for a week with a full set of Hansard, you'd really be able to come up with a watertight answer. But I think certainly the JSCEM has had a beneficial effect in educating a great many people on the subject, and I think a fair few members. I think the fairly outrageous critical things are no longer said by members of Parliament, but said by people outside Parliament. But whether they've been put up to doing that by members of Parliament is a different question again. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Roger Wettenhall from the University of Canberra. Hello, God.
Hi.
I want to ask you a question which really extends a comment you made. I made a note of it. But in doing that, could I just have a few moments to explain the background that I come from in this. You were saying in going through your list of questions at the end that one of them was about the possibility for the legislature to act as a counterbalance to executive power.
Yeah.
My question really is them, given that there has not been much controversy about electoral administration in Australia, it seems to have been fairly conducted, in the light of the something like the URIG report in the Commonwealth on statutory authorities generally, it's a, And the report is obviously designed to drag them much further back into the area of ministerial influence, to curtail their autonomy. Now, in the light of that, is there a feeling within the electoral administration itself that it is now necessary to get the legislature set up to act as a counterbalance, as you put it? Now, just in saying that, can I just say that I was at a conference of the International Institute of Administrative Sciences in Mexico about 9 months ago. And you mentioned Mexico, and the case of the Mexican Electoral Institute, I think it is, was an interesting case there. But the interest was very much in what you might call integrity agencies, in audit officers, ombudsmen, anti-corruption commissions, bodies like that, and electoral bodies, in establishing them as a special category of statutory bodies where governments like to have them, but because they get embarrassed by them quite often, then curtail their funding and so on, so that they're more like window dressing than effective instruments. And there was a lot of interest in that, stemming mainly on audit officers, ombudsmen, institutions of that sort. But as I say, electoral bodies got mentioned. And in the discussions that took place there, it seemed to me that, I've just made a note of them, in South Africa, in Mexico itself, in the United Kingdom, and in Victoria now, in Australia, there is a movement towards a special category of officers of Parliament. I don't mean clerks of houses, but I mean people like this, which are heading statutory bodies with a degree of independence from the executive government, in danger of losing that independence, so needing special parliamentary protections. And it seems to me that New Zealand, a few years ago, took a great initiative in formalising this notion of officers of Parliament, but strikingly, and compared with the others I've mentioned, didn't mention the electoral administration. The others did. So my question really is there much sense within the Australian electoral administration of the need to push for stronger parliamentary protection?
I wouldn't presume to answer the last part of it because I've been no longer part of the AEC for a very long time. So they could speak for themselves about the current situation. I think the general point that you make about lack of interest in shifts between the executive and quite possibly both other branches is a matter of the old frog boiling metaphor. The frog is only gradually becoming unhappy about this. Again, to personalise the response, sound rather like a plea in mitigation. The client had the misfortune not to have lived under responsible government till he was 20 years old, has left me with a permanent prejudice against the executive branch. And to that extent, seeing a legislative committee set up to deal with the electoral administration, I threw my hat in the air and cried hurrah when it was happening in 1984. You mentioned South Africa and England, and I think this can be said correctly. Both were very conscious of the Australian Commission model when they moved along those lines, the English very explicitly so, and the South Africans more or less taking it in trust because it was fairly early in the piece. And there is a lot of serious talk around the world about this sort of problem, but it's very difficult to seize a constitutional tradition and a constitutional regime, for example, in Latin American countries, and reverse this drastically. In the United States, of course, there was the long tradition of the independent regulatory agencies floating like he who had better not be named in these circumstances, coffin halfway between heaven and earth. And this meant that when they turned to electoral administration and to set up a federal body, they had an opportunity to do something worthwhile, and instead of which they created a Federal Electoral Commission that has one function and said it should be composed half of Republicans and half of Democrats, and ended up in the court as to whether it would be proper, by plea reference to the courts, not liking separation of powers violations, that it all had to come out of the executive. Although obviously consultation would be possible, but there's no way that you could have the executive and the Senate and maybe the courts getting together to produce a body that was, if not independent, at least came from all three branches of government. So I agree with almost all that you're saying, but it's very difficult to do other than the slow process of the Mexicans. I mean, the Mexicans started up with a body that wasn't worth powder and shot, and by a series of acts of will, turned it into a very respectable institution, which appears to have stood on the edge of a civil war and faced down the mob, and Mexico's back and running normally. So there are wins.
Thank you. Kevin Bryant, I just had a question. You mentioned, I think in the introduction, your role in the Bjelke-Petersen gerrymander was mentioned. I actually grew up under the Playford gerrymander, and shortly after I moved to Canberra, a great time ago now, that was actually reformed by Dunstan and Steele Hall, of course. But and gradually over the years, there has been a lot of reform in most of the state electoral systems, but we still have a situation in some state upper houses, I think in Western Australia, where there's a slightly undesirable situation. Would you comment on the state situation and particularly on upper houses?
I think there are two problems with state upper houses. Well, three, if you count not having one like Queensland. But you can say it's going to be about proportional representation and then have so few members elected per district that, in fact, what you're doing is ensuring a fairly fair go between the two major parties and leaving everybody else, you hope, on the outer, only to have that system turn around and bite you, as happened with the Victorians, who did that and ended up resuscitating the DLP that we'd all thought had passed from the scene. So there's that problem of getting PR right. The other problem is the ratio of seats to electors. Now, some sort of deal was done in West Australia. I don't know anything about the circumstances, that at least that the lower house would be going over to more or less one vote, one value, and you could have the upper house still with a heavy rural weightage. I mean, it's potentially, I suppose you could say, another recognition of having two bob each way. You have one elected from single-member constituencies and preferential voting. You have one elected from multi-member constituencies with proportional representation. You have one that's malapportioned and one that isn't malapportioned. If you think malapportionment's a bad thing, then there's a problem. I don't know enough about sentiments in West Australia to know whether this is a sentiment bubbling away beneath the surface and will soon break through. I think it more likely, if you look at the history of electoral, drastic electoral changes anywhere, either you have to have a disaster or a long shot of averting a disaster by doing something now to cause people to change the rules. One of the difficulties about electoral reform is you have to go to a body of people and say the means by which you got here is flawed and ought to be changed. And this is pushing up a fairly steep hill. But there are occasions, I mean, the Senate going over to proportional representation in 1948-49 is undoubtedly the Labour Party seeing dark clouds gathering on the horizon and buying a bit more time in the Senate to make Menzies' life miserable for a year or two. And certainly things would never have happened in Queensland if a body set up to ostensibly in the first instance to address problems in the police force, said one of the problems in the police force is because the electoral system is so crook, and therefore an independent body was given an opportunity of doing something with it. It is possible occasionally to sell a slightly qualified system, to be, again, talk about Queensland and the abolition of the gerrymander. When the zonal system was abolished, EARC, of which I was a member, retained a form of weightage, a novel form of weightage, for a small number of seats. And there was some grizzling from the purists in the Labour Party about this. But I must say, since then, there have been a number of elections, and I think at one election I noticed in small print and a story about that size that somebody in the Country Party had said that there shouldn't be big districts. But I think a dispute that had been going on since the 19th century was resolved by a good principle and a slight bit of compromise, saying that there are times when you have to modify principle to accommodate local situations. To let you into the proceedings of EARC, the five of us sat there with a refidex and worked out how long, if you were the member of Gregory and you'd visited all towns over 500 in your constituency, drove through at the speed limit and just shouted, "Hi, I'm your member," as you passed through. And if you drove all night, you could do it in 2 days. And that didn't really seem representation. So a formula was suggested to us, which seemed admirable, and we adopted it, and it's been now adopted in West Australia. And I think that's how you do get changes from time to time. It may well be that there are other machinery things, for example, going back to how do you choose the members of a body that is very sensitive, like the Australian Electoral Commission? Should a word be had with the leader of the opposition before the names go forward to the Governor-General in Council? There are such jobs. It's probably a good idea. But that'll be decided not because it's a sound principle, but because Bloggs tried it 10 years ago and it turned into an utter dog's breakfast of squabbling and abuse. So until the generation that remembers that has passed from the scene, you won't be able to get that fine principle up on its legs again. That's how the system works, unfortunately.
Three more, one towards the back, one right at the back, and one down the front. I think that will see us clear, unfortunately. So would you like to?
Marion Saul, Democratic Audit of Australia, the Australian National University. Colin, you've suggested that the convention that's emerged that Australian electoral commissioners only serve one term is a good thing. But I was wondering if there aren't some advantages in such offices being filled through some kind of bipartisan process, as you've just alluded to, and that they be filled for life, as, you know, the chief electoral officer in Canada is, and have that kind of accumulating authority and standing and so on, which life appointments give. I mean, I think that positions such as Clerk of the Senate are another example where appointment for life may be a good idea. Thanks.
I think it would be hard to sell. I think, in fact, a single term has some advantages that aren't tied necessarily to the question of independence. I was appointed for a 7-year term, and 5 years and some couple of months into it, the Commonwealth announced that whatever the statutory provision was, hereafter they'd be appointing people only for 5-year terms, not merely the AEC, but all their statutory appointments. And it got me to thinking about the matter, and it did seem to me, not in terms of independence, but in terms of doing the job, that after about 5 years, if you haven't got something done and you try to raise it again, people would say, oh, he's not going on about that again, is he? And 5 years was really about the time to either keep a thing on the rails if it was satisfactory in the rails, or shake it up and clear out and let some see whether it worked under anybody else. And the dangers of the life appointment is people then start watching you too closely for little foibles. Did you notice that he did something in this morning that he didn't ordinarily do? The old boy's losing it. I can remember seeing one of the last two life professors at Oxford. Gilbert Murray was one, but I never saw him. R.W. Lee, who used to lecture in Roman Dutch law, used to come down to the Inns of Court once a week to lecture in Roman Dutch law to half a dozen salon students, as they were in those days. And seeing this 90-year-old figure sort of tottering along the back of the law courts made me think probably a retirement age is good for professors, judges, and a lot of other people. But I don't think a life term necessarily is the best way of getting at things. I think if I, again, had a choice from the flounder, I'd certainly go for seeing if there's some conceivable way of involving the opposition in saying, is this job, is this person acceptable to you? And seeing if the flood of vile abuse that they produced contained any germ of truth that it might be worth your while to know about.
Well, afternoon, Professor. My name's Alyssa Badgery. This is my son, Archer. I just have an interest...
Tell him about provisional voting when he's 17.
Yeah, I'll enroll him now. I have an interest... when we think about the history of Australian politics, we see that some elections are decided in a landslide and some are decided by the tally of a handful of marginal seats. And we may have a government come into office that has indeed been elected by perhaps the sum of three or four marginal seats, may be less than 500 votes on an extreme example. I'm interested in the increasingly apathetic state of Australian society about political affairs. I'm interested in the impact of the large number of informal votes, which can be sometimes between 5% and 6% of the total number of votes cast. I'm just wondering as to what your thoughts are on how we can minimise the impact of glitches in or marginal seats or in times of tight elections where the true will of the people may not come into in force due to opportunities for marginal electorates to be targeted?
There are a number of problems in the questions you raise. One of the consequences of having single-member seats is that you get odd mixes because the population isn't spread evenly over the over the districts. You don't have 17 bank managers, 23 doctors, 45 wharfies allocated to each constituency. This also varies quite considerably by area. I noticed in the papers in the last day or so somebody speculating about the forthcoming federal election and making the point that there's a lot more potential for trouble for the government in Queensland and Western Australia than in the three other mainland states. And the answer is that's always been the case, and it's to do with the geography of Sydney, Melbourne and Adelaide as against the geography of Perth and Brisbane. Perth and Brisbane are all mixed up with lumps of wharfies here right next to lumps of bank managers there, whereas in Adelaide, slightly less than used to be the case, and Melbourne and Sydney, there are lines that you can draw on the map, and there may be a marginal seat, a Parramatta of late, that's been sitting on the fault line, and that's why marginals matter. Now, the second point about marginals is there are very few divisions that are habitual offenders. This year's marginal seat is unlikely to be next year's. About the only seat that's worth treating as a habitual offender is Eden Monero, and that's presumably why Mr. Nairn's been made minister, that he ought to be more sensitized than most to these problems. The management of things, put it as generally as that, the management of things to capitalize on that is very hard to do in practice because you can't pick the horse to nobble, which leads you then into the sort of extreme interpretations that are occasionally put about underground armies of 20 or 30,000 people who turn out. Each party, or at least the Labour Party, there's more of it under the water than there is above it, sort of theories. Where it can matter is when you look at aggregates, and that's why it's more likely to matter for the Senate. Manipulating informal voting for the Senate is worth having a couple of bob on, because a vote wasted in Bradfield is as effective as a vote wasted in Parramatta, which is a marginal seat, or Fowler, which is a safe Labour seat. And therefore, if you manipulate the system of voting for the Senate, there could be a bit of pay dirt at the end of it. It doesn't mean you'll wipe out the opposition, but that sixth seat might just fall across the line. Doing it for the House of Representatives would be buying a lottery ticket and hoping your number comes up. This is why in 1983, above the line voting was introduced by a Labour government, because they were taking a shellacking in Senate informal voting. You had only to look at the informal vote for the Senate by division to see that there were very few Liberal votes being lost in Bradfield and a terrible lot of Labour votes being lost in Fowler. And therefore, most of the what you might term suspect argument that's going on at the moment are valid reasons being put forward for changing the ticket voting system. I'm not just saying this to annoy Marion, but there are some other persons with an axe to grind about the ticket voting system who might be thinking of the long-term benefit that would be received by pushing the Senate informal vote back to where it was 20 years ago, which is throwing out one in 10 or likely to be more nowadays. As for the problem of people being fed up with the political system and therefore not paying attention to politics, or worse, not turning out to vote if voting was no longer compulsory, I think this is a very considerable problem. It's a worldwide problem. I used to think that teaching civics in the schools and bodies like the Electoral Commission are doing worthwhile things would help. That faith has been sadly damaged by reading what other similar countries have tried to do and how intractable the problem really is for a whole variety of socioeconomic, educational, media competition reasons. I think, therefore, that keeping compulsory voting is by far the safest course that we have open to us. If we abolished it, I think we would have a transitional stage in which the habituals would continue to come out of the voters over an age that would gradually sort of move through the cohorts. The people who'd started voting 30 years ago are pretty well habituated, and the people who are under, say, 25 would take the first opportunity they got and stay away, or most of them would. And it's really that debate about compulsion that I think needs to be watched, and whether that might be opened up again in the near future.
We have one last question.
Professor, and I hope I have your wish as I journey through life. You're still very astute, and there's a lot to learn. I'm actually from Eden Monero, standing as an independent, and I have approached Professor Saw about electoral probity, the raising of print allowances, and the special minister appears to stumble over his feet where he shouldn't in terms of administrative errors in polling community organisations and also tacking a little bit of polling information on the end of, you know, the print budget information for the electorate. So I'm quite concerned about the diluting of the democratic processes through using raised print allowances and raising the ceiling on disclosures. The fact that our year 11 and 12 students don't get that electoral education anymore, so there's disenfranchisement of the, you know, potential youth voters. So I wonder if you have any comments how we can actually shore up the Electoral Act to make sure that we're protecting democratic rights for all Australians.
The Electoral Act's a bit like a tax act. You can suppose at any given moment that a lot of experienced shrewd people are out there tapping any thing that they can find. Marshall Mannheim, the great Finnish leader, said the Russians are window rattlers. They constantly walk around and they rattle every window they see, and if it's open, they go in. And the Electoral Act's a bit like that. There are people rattling the windows all the time. I think the incumbency advantage, to put a general label on some of the things that you were on about, is causing a lot of concern at the present time. For the narrower subject matter that I was concerned with, the first question, I suppose, is whether this should be a responsibility of the Electoral Commission or Commissioner, or whether a separate statutory officer, for example, on government advertising, ought to be set up to say you can't do that and then either issue an injunction or go to the court for an injunction to get a breach. In a bit of the paper that I dropped out, that was the experience, of course, with the referendum held in 1988. The Labour government, which was producing the favourable case, had, of course, an interest in the constitutional changes that they wished to achieve. And they were putting out, I think, the Attorney General, Lionel Bowen, was the name that appeared as authorising on them. And the words went something like, the Founding Fathers said the people should be able to change the Constitution, and this is what we want to do. The Liberals, understandably, took exception to the second half of that and objected to its association with the first half. The Electoral Commission, the Commission narrowly confined to the three members, looked at the Act and held it up to the light and wet our fingers and touched it, and we didn't think that it was in breach of the prohibition in the Referendum Act against spending government money on promoting one side or the other. It was stating a historical fact. The Founding Fathers had intended that the people should be able to change the Constitution from time to time. Peter Reith, who was the shadow minister responsible for electoral matters, took a different view. Said to us, you ought to stop it. We said, we don't believe it, but if you want to stop it, you're perfectly entitled to go to the court. We said, go to the court. He said, I don't think I can go to the court. We said, suck it and see. He went to the court and immediately returned with a piece of paper signed by one High Court judge saying he was right, and the matter was disposed of in a short period of time. Now, there may be problems that can't be resolved as satisfactorily as that. But what I think you need when you're really at the coalface, if the story has to be killed instantly before it sort of gets out, then what you really want is somebody who is dedicated to raising such questions, authorised to go to the court and get something out of the court. to give you an example, when I was practicing as a lawyer, ended up suing a newspaper in the magistrate's court because that was the only place that I could get a judgment in the time to deny that my candidate, as the newspaper had said there were only three ladies in the constituency and proceeded to name them. And by getting the maximum £25 out of the magistrate's court, we could at least say, you see, they're liars. It's a very tight time frame when you're in the last 4 weeks or so. You've got to have access to the courts, and you've got to have somebody who may be a party but may not be a party. Things, maybe both the major parties are sort of doing it, and it's an isolated independent who wants justice, and somebody who's dedicated to go to the court. The AEC has a number of statutory provisions which I haven't talked about, entitling it to raise defects in the conduct of a poll when they believe it. I mean, they're the best placed people to know whether there's been a defect in the conduct of the poll, because they'll hear about it immediately in all the wash-up processes. And if they hear about it, then they ought to be obliged to take it before the court and say, maybe Blogg shouldn't have been elected, and put it where it deserved to go. But there are other matters that aren't a matter of turfing out Blogs and either having another election, which is what the court ordinarily orders now, or detecting Smith elected, or alternatively getting the record straight in the last couple of days of, you know, furious campaigning and saying, no, this is what the truth of the matter is. Here's a learned judge who's just said that, which brings me back to what I was saying about judges have been independent since fairly soon after the Restoration, and people tend to believe what judges say, not perhaps as much as they would have a few years ago.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you'll please join me in thanking Professor Hughes for what's been a very entertaining lunchtime lecture. And very informative on many, many levels. Thank you, Professor. And I also hope that you'll do two other things. One is to join us on the 20th of April for our next lecture by Associate Professor Paul Reynolds. And finally, I'm not sure whether the clerk is watching our broadcast in the building or not, but I hope you will all be my witnesses when I report to him that Marianne Sawyer wishes him a life sentence. Good afternoon, and thank you very much.